Hi everybody, welcome to our seminar session. Today is a special session. We are starting launching the PhD Pitchwork series. It's a new thing that we would like to do every once or twice a semester, where we have groups of PhD candidates who present their work, and we're very excited to hear from them today. We will just go by the order that fits best, and we will go through like 5 minute pitches, and then perhaps if there's urgent questions, we might answer one or two in between talks while we set up the next talk. But if you have anything major to ask or so, we might save that to the end, where we then have a joint Q&A session. Yeah, without much further ado, we start with Eleonora. And Eleonora, you might just quickly introduce yourself.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here. I'm a PhD student with Hannah Williams. And today I'm gonna talk to you a bit about the big picture of my PhD project, which title is Optimal Movement Theory, the Economy of Decision-Making in Animal Movement. So now think about a case where you are in your car and you want to drive to a city, and your car has a very small fuel tank, and you have to think about that eventually you need to fill up the gas, but you don't know exactly where the gas stations are. And there are on the way, but you don't know exactly where. And moreover, some of them might be open and some might be closed. You don't know which ones. Of course, if you see other cars in the line waiting to fill up the gas, you know for sure that that gas station is open. Plus, you might know that some area on the way are usually there is usually a high traffic jam, and in some others there might be your friends and you want to pass by. So based on all of this information plus other information you might know about gas prices or again traffic jam on the way, you need to find the best path to get where you want. So this kind of problem is what animals face whenever they want to move to reach a certain point in the space. And in their case, the space is given by multiple resource landscapes, both environmental landscape and resource landscape like food, mates, or predators. And based on all of this information, they might find their best path to get where they want. And we believe that when animal makes choices, they optimize energy, and based on all the resources they are facing. And this kind of problems is what they face multiple times during the lifetime. And that's why energy optimization is key when asking ecological questions. And this applies to any animal or things that move in the space while finding resources. So in our group, we use soaring flight as a model system due to their extreme dependence on environmental energy as a resource for reduced movement cost. So both obligate soaring flights and paragliders use this thermal updraft of air to gain height, gain energy, and then move in space and get where they want. Soaring flight happens in a dynamic environment where these thermals come and go with a different level of dynamism in time. And thus, predictability is an important aspect and strictly linked with the social information. This because an individual can see others thermaling up, and then in this way has access to the information that there is a good resource in that point in the space and can rely on it. In my PhD project, I'm trying to go back and forth between real and simulated data and theoretical models, trying to integrate this multiple energy landscape and the social component as information for reduced uncertainty, and hopefully trying to shape optimal movement theory as a framework that would help us understanding individual and collective decision movement decisions. At the moment, I'm mainly using computational modeling, like agent-based models, where I simulate the system and the interaction between the agents. But I would like to integrate this framework with a more theoretical approach, trying to integrate movement ecology problems with statistical physics models or mathematical models. And how to do so is what I'm trying to figure out right now. So if you have any feedback about it or any input, I would be very happy to talk about it. That's it. So in this moment, I'm just using a location of thermals and the quality of thermals, like the wind speed, vertical wind speed. And so far, that's all I'm using, and social information, like accessing where so individuals don't see this unless there is someone thermaling there. No. Not yet.
Continue setting up the next talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so
much. Thank you. Oh, hi, everyone. My name's Emily, and I'm a fourth year PhD student in the Department of the Ecology of Animal Societies down at Buchlerstrasse. And my PhD is supervised by Ariana Strangberg-Peschkin and Meg Crowfoot. And today I'm going to talk to you about some of my PhD work where I've been exploring the drivers of fission fusion dynamics in white-nosed coatis. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. My animation. So as you all know, there's costs and benefits to group living. Benefits include reduced predation risk, increased food discovery rates, and resource defense against competitors. But there's also costs to group living, such as increased foraging competition, increased risk of within-group aggression, and faster depletion of resources. And fission fusion is a process where groups split into smaller subunits and come back together again. And this varies over spatial and temporal scales. And it's seen as a flexible method to maintain the benefits of group living while minimizing those costs. So a question that I'm particularly interested in, which you hopefully, I will just say it, is what determines subgroup membership? So who is splitting with who? And I'm also interested in what's driving these groups to split. So what are the decision-making processes that are underlying these fissions as well as fusions? And how are animals communicating during these processes? So to understand this, I'm using white-nosed coatis as my study system. They're members of the prostinid family, so they're closely related to raccoons and kinkajous. They're diurnal and omnivorous, so they spend a majority of their time foraging on the forest floor, eating fruits and insects. The females are group living, and the males are solitary, only joining groups during the breeding season. And group size fluctuates throughout the year, and that correlates with fruitfall availability. So to look at fission fusion dynamics, we simultaneously tracked full groups of coatis in Panama along the Panama Canal. So the first group we caught was just outside Gamboa, and this was Galaxy Group, and this was 11 individuals. And then we caught a Presidente group on Barra Colorada Island, and this group had 16 individuals. And we recorded simultaneous high-resolution GPS data with audio data. And what was really cool when we got the results back is that we did see that both of these groups did exhibit fission fusion behaviors. And so my PhD was defined for me, and I was going to analyze these fission fusion events. And so this was really cool because this is the first quantitative evidence of fission fusion in this species. So to look at fission fusion, we define subgrouping using dBScan, which is a clustering method. So imagine you have groups of individuals. We put radii around each individual, and if those radii are overlapping, they're classed as being in the same subgroup. And with this, we can look across the total data set and measure the proportion of time each individual was in the same subgroup. So here we've got matrices with galaxy group of all the group members. And if they're more yellow, they're more often together. And if they're more blue, they're less often together. And you can see that there's these two clear subgrouping patterns emerging. And when we statistically tested this, we found that they are consistently splitting with these same individuals over time. We found the same pattern in the other group, Presidente, where instead of it being an even spinning group, we had this smaller subgroup leaving the main subgroup. And what was cool is when we correlated these subgrouping patterns with age and sex homophily, as well as relatedness, we found that relatedness predicted subgroup membership in both of these groups. And if you want to know more, we have a preprint out on BioArchive. So my next question was, what drives groups to split? And looking at vocalizations particularly, because with vocalizations, we can see whether it's within group conflict driving splits, whether it's different foraging preferences, or perhaps it's just random drift. So these are just some preliminary results of a fission event. And so we have aggression calls and contact call rates before and after a fission. And what we found is that with aggression calls, which look like this, this is a chittering event, there wasn't any change in aggression before or after fissions. But we did find for contact calls, there's an increase in contact calling rate before a split. And so this is suggesting that perhaps it's individuals have different preferences on when to leave the group. And here's an example of one event. On the top plot is the group that leaves first, and the bottom plot is the group that leaves second. And we can see the group that leaves first has a higher contact calling rate before they're splitting, and then the group that's then following has a higher contact call rate when they're leaving. And this is just preliminary, and this is something I'm working on right now. And so my next steps are to characterize these fission and fusion types and correlate these types with their vocal behavior to determine what these drivers are of these fission and fusion events. And with that, I'd like to say thank you to everyone who's part of the project, particularly my collaborators and the people that helped me catch and collar full groups of Coatis, as well as all the funny bodies and the Coatis themselves. So thank you.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, Ahmed.
Just curious, how do you record the vocalizations?
We use sirocas, which are these very small microphones, and we put them inside a 3D printed casing in the collar.
So yeah. You know who is producing.
We know who's calling, yeah.
Thanks for the talk. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how frequently these events occur, and also how long the groups stay apart from each other before going back together.
Yeah, so the frequency varies. So within a day, you can have events that are like a few minutes long, and sometimes it's multiple days. So it's really variable. And the number of events we have for Galaxy Group, about 100, and for Presidente Group, we have, well, probably 150 to 200, depending on what you count as an event. Yeah. And this is across a 2-week period, I forgot to say.
Do you have any idea why there might be such a difference between the two groups?
I think, you can, with Galaxy Group, they're dividing quite evenly. So the group sizes are evenly big. But in Presidente Group, you've got that smaller subgroup of only like 3 individuals. And so it's too maybe risky to be in a tiny group for a longer duration. So they're coming back probably more regularly. And also the adult female in that smaller subgroup, her juveniles are in the main group. So she's probably coming back to check on them as well.
Thanks.
There's time for one quick question, if somebody volunteers. No? Then we move on to the next talk. Thank you so much, Emily. Beautiful. Next one is Catherine.
All right. Thank you, Alexandra. My name is Catherine. I'm also a PhD student in the Department for the Ecology of Animal Societies at Buchstasse. I'm in the Barbara Fries group. And my research is mostly focused on uncovering factors that influence intergroup encounters in a wild bonobo population. So intergroup encounters occur across the animal kingdom. They can be loosely defined as a visual or acoustical interaction between individuals from 2 distinct social groups. And they can range from highly affiliative to highly aggressive. And they can have significant consequences for social relationships both within and between groups, as well as group space use and individual survival and reproduction. And they're also thought to be foundational to the formation of multi-level societies like ours. And animals interact for a variety of reasons, but some of the main ones are to gain access to resources or to gain mutual fitness benefits. But whatever the motivation, it's often driven by a complex interplay of social and ecological factors. And for my PhD, I'm using bonobos as a model system to try to tease apart some of these social and ecological factors to see how they influence bonobo intergroup encounters, and on a broader level, gain some insight into the formation of multi-level societies. Bonobos are an excellent species to do this because they live in these mixed sex groups with high fission-fusion dynamics, and they show flexible behavior during intergroup encounters. And collectively, these traits bring about notable variation in who interacts and how. So if you take a look at this GIF of two bonobo groups interacting, you can probably think of a lot of questions to ask about this encounter, ranging from why did the two groups interact in the first place, to what drove certain behaviors during the interaction. And today I'm going to share with you a study I did asking the question, how do social factors influence the probability of an encounter? So for this study, I set out to test four hypotheses. The first one is that these encounters provide extra group mating opportunities for females. And so for this one, I predicted that as you have an increase in the number of sexually receptive females, you have an increase in the encounter probability. The second one is that they also provide extra group mating opportunities for males. And for this one, I predicted that when you have an increase in within-group male mate competition, you also have an increase in encounter probability, with the idea being that if a male is facing more competition within his own group, he might be more motivated to seek opportunities elsewhere. The third one is that these encounters are really important opportunities for young females of dispersal age, that I call potential migrant females, to gain valuable social information about their neighbors that they may transfer to at a later date, and also to safely transfer to these groups. And so for this hypothesis, I predicted that if you have an increase in the number of these potential migrant females, you will also have an increase in the encounter probability. And finally, the fourth hypothesis is that encounters carry some risk of infanticide with them. And assuming this is true, I predicted that as you have an increase in the number of females who have infants that are vulnerable to infanticide, you'll have a decrease in encounter probability in order to mitigate this risk. So for the study, I used data collected at the Louis Cattel Field Site in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Africa. The research there has been ongoing since 2002, and it's home to two fully habituated bonobo groups. For my study, I used data collected on these two groups between May 2016 and December 2020. And here you can just see the home ranges of these two groups and the overlap shown in dark blue. Over this time period, there were 818 days when two groups or subgroups were followed at the same time. And I highlight subgroups here because, as I explained, they're high fission fusions. So on any given day, you often had researchers just following a subset of individuals. Of these 818 days, there were 79 cases where two subgroups came into contact range. And of these, 49 resulted in encounters and 30 were non-contact cases. So these 79 cases became the response variable for my model. So if it was an encounter, it was scored as a yes. If it was a non-contact case, it was scored as a no. And then I came up with a variable to test each hypothesis. So the first one, to look at extra group mating opportunities for females, I used the total number of maximally tumescent females across the subgroups. And this is just the number of females with these really swollen sexual swellings. To look at extra group mating opportunities for males, I looked at the sum of the operational sex ratio across two groups. So this is just the ratio of sexually mature males to sexually receptive females. To look at this third hypothesis, I used the total number of potential migrant females across the two subgroups. And finally, to look at infanticide risk, I looked at this total number of these females with vulnerable infants. So that was the model. And it was fit as a generalized linear model with logistic regression in the Bayesian framework. And these are the results. So on the right-hand side, you have the posterior distribution of our first variable, which is the total number of maximally tumescent females. The thick blue line just shows the median of the distribution. The shaded area is the 95% credible interval. And the black dashed line is just there to give you an idea of where zero is on the graph. And on the right-hand side, you have the conditional effects plot. So you see the total number of tumescent females increasing on the x-axis and the probability of an encounter on the y-axis. And if you take a look at this posterior distribution, it almost perfectly straddles zero. So we can take this as evidence that there's no effect of this variable on our response. However, if you take a look at the sum of the operational sex ratio, you see that most of the distribution falls to the right of zero. And if you do something that's called hypothesis testing, you see that you get a probability of 0.97 that the slope of this variable will be positive. So it means 97% of the time, an increase in the sum of the operational sex ratio will likely result in an increase in your probability of an encounter. So we can say overall it has a pretty notable effect. And the same is true for the total number of potential migrant females. Most of the time, if you get an increase in the number of these females, you get an increase in the probability of an encounter. And if we look at the total number of females with vulnerable infants, we see the opposite. So if you get an increase in these females, most of the time you'll get a decrease in the probability of an encounter. So overall, the studies show no evidence that extra group mating opportunities for females increase the probability of an encounter, but we did find evidence for our other three hypotheses. And I think overall this shows that changes in bonobo group subgroup competition can influence the decisions of those two groups to interact over time. And with that, I want to say thank you to my thesis advisory committee and all the people and the funders of the Louis Cattell Bonobo Project who have supported me and my thesis. Thanks to all of you guys here for listening and online, and to the cluster for giving me the chance to present some of my research. And I'd be happy to take questions.
Thanks so much, Catherine. Questions?
Hey, thanks. Do you have an idea, like, how do the encounters usually look like? Like, why is there an increased risk for infanticide, for example?
Oh, that's a really good question. So actually, in the literature, if you go through it, you won't find much on infanticide in bonobos, because they're thought to be the hippie, peaceful great ape. But actually, at our site, we've seen an increase in both the frequency and the aggressiveness of counters, which is other things I'm looking at in my PhD. And we're really trying to figure that out right now, like why at our site there is this risk of infanticide, but clearly this shows that when they're making decisions about whether to interact, it might play a role in influencing that. So, but yeah, stay tuned for the other stuff.
More questions? If not, we might include, if there's anything on your mind still coming up, we might include it in the final Q&A.
Also, feel free to contact me at my email if you think of anything down the line.
Absolutely.
I love any feedback you guys have.
Thanks so much, Catherine. So we move on with Maya.
Hi, everybody. My name is Maya, and I'm a first-year PhD student in Ian's lab and also very new member of the cluster, so I'm excited to tell you guys about my research. This is one of the projects I've been working on the coevolution of cooperative swimming in robot fish. So all of this is motivated by a paper that came out in 2016 on Hemigrammis blaheri, and it was looking at the proportion of time that fish spent in synchronized swimming states. And the way synchronized swimming states were defined was according to the tail beat of the two fish and the relative phase difference between them. So a synchronized state would be a phase difference of zero or pi, so in phase or antiphase. And everything in between is considered non-synchronized. And what this paper found was that especially for higher swimming speeds, fish spend the majority of their time in synchronized states. So this made us curious about why. And Liang decided to follow up this paper with a study using pairs of robotic fish. And what he did is he measured the power cost of different phase differences and the velocity of different phase differences to see if this is optimized for the individual fish or not. Why are they swimming in a synchronized way? But what he actually found is that while speed is optimized for the individual fish, this is because the fish were kind of bound to each other. They were always going to swim at the same speed. On the level of the individual, power cost was not optimized. It was actually pretty dismal for both of the fish involved. So this opens up a lot of questions, like why would fish evolve to swim in a way that is not beneficial for themselves? And if you look at the blue line on the top plot, this is the power cost of the unit, the collective unit. And this is actually optimized. So it seems that fish may have evolved to swim cooperatively, but we don't know how that happened and whether it's due to some innate altruistic nature, some consideration of the collective, or emergent from a game theoretic background. Like, are they selfishly, greedily trying to swim and just accidentally being cooperative? So this is something that I looked into using game theory. It's a pretty standard approach that I did. I have a payoff matrix taken from Liang's data from the robotic fish, and then it's subject to some noise, which I'll talk about later. And the fish update their phases according to their payoff with different update algorithms. And I have a host of different candidate algorithms. These are very minimalist and not entirely biologically inspired at this point, but my main focus is trying to see, can I get them to evolve to cooperatively swim without assuming much about what fish are able to perceive while swimming? Because there's a lot of literature about the limitations in perception during swimming for fish. So I have these four models. One of them is continuous, so considering all phase differences from 0 to 2 pi, and the others are discrete, just four different phase differences. And the results were pretty positive for a bunch of different noise conditions. For both continuous and discrete, I was able to show that they evolved to preferentially select synchronized phase differences. And I also was able to produce some interesting behaviors like dynamic preferences. That is something to be explored later with one of my memory models. But I was curious about the effect of noise on this game theory model. So I played around with different magnitudes and noise distributions. And I found that for high noise magnitudes, it really does matter which kind of noise distribution I'm drawing from. So if you look at the rightmost plot over there, if I'm drawing from a uniform distribution, I'm still selecting 0 and pi, the synchronized states, after x iterations. Then this is with 100 samples. But if I use a normal or Laplace distribution, this isn't so robust anymore. And we know that fish are swimming in low Reynolds number environments. There's a lot of noise. So it does matter what kind of noise they are subject to. So a way of looking into this is by using robotic fish. What I did is I tried to embody the update algorithms that I was simulating in these fish, and they were in real time drawing payoffs by measuring the current in their motors that is used to beat their tails, and that is subject to real noise. So I don't have to make any assumptions about what the noise in the environment is. Of course, it's also subject to intrinsic noise, which has been a problem for me, unfortunately. So I'm in the process right now of trying to play around with different hardware and doing a lot of calibration to make sure that I am not attributing noise that is just like changing resistance in the wires to the turbulence between the fish. So in the future, I hope to successfully implement this into the robotic fish. It's something I think I'm very close to doing, actually. And from then on, I want to explore more biologically realistic update algorithms from reinforcement learning. One that I'm seriously thinking about is partially observable Markov games. So if you guys know a lot about it, I'm doing my research, but I would love to talk to you about it because it's confusing. here are my references, and I want to thank everyone who's been helping me and all of you for listening.
Yeah, thanks. Do you think there's a sensory component to the synchrony as well, outside of just the energy landscape, like a visual component or something like that? And could you investigate it?
I'm sure there is. And right now, because it's only two fish, I'm not really considering that because I know that they are perceiving the one neighbor. I'm not doing any like visual modeling to see what they're perceiving, but I absolutely think so. And I also think I'm using a sensor, which is the current output in the motor. And I know that in real fish, it's going to be a lot more sophisticated, probably prone to less noise. But I'm hoping that I'm going to get the general shape from this. I want to know what it's like in between the two fish with the turbulent water. But yeah, I absolutely think so. And I mean, I hope that in the future, this can be expanded to more fish as well. And in that case, I would have to definitely incorporate things like visual field.
Thank you. Thanks, Maya, so much. And we continue with Lachlan.
Thank you. So hi, everybody. I'm Lachlan. I'm part of the Visual Neuropathology Lab, or the Anna Schuckel Workgroup. I'm a first-year PhD student with the IMPRS. And today, I'm going to talk to you about visual motor lateralization of the hawk moth proboscis. So this might seem like a bit of a loaded term. So I hope by the end of this, we can kind of understand more together. So first, I want to talk about lateralization, or directional bias. So lateralization can be thought of as a preference or a tendency to perform a behavior with some kind of lateral direction, or with a specific limb. So if you're performing a behavior to the left or to the right, or if you're using a left or a right limb, this is what I mean when I'm discussing lateralization. This presumably comes from some kind of nervous specialization, and we know that it can vary between individuals and also at a population level. So this is a pretty interesting kind of realm of research, because right now a lot of computational or theoretical models are trying to understand decision making in individuals, and that often includes spatial decision making, which might tie into making a left or rightwards decision. So what we're trying to get at with this experiment and with this study is looking at kind of a biological or behavioral aspect of lateralization. And I guess I should give you another note. This is about the first project of the PhD. I should have said that at the beginning, but yeah, this is like the quick overview of everything I'm doing currently. So lateralization in, in insects is pretty interesting because they have such an extreme diversity of behaviors and morphologies, so that also leads to an extreme diversity of lateralizations. And we know in insects that they have individual and population level biases. We know that this can depend on context, so sensory or locomotory mode or social influence. And for ultimate mechanisms of lateralization, where it arises from, what the function is still kind of up in the air. So there's not really a agreed upon idea of what function this serves. So what we're hoping to look at is lateralization in the hummingbird hawk moth. So this is a really cool diurnal insect pollinator, and it hovers entirely while it's feeding. So it uses its long proboscis to kind of probe flowers and find the central nectary. So this is a pretty neat model for visual motor tasks because they're integrating visual information as well as this motor control of both the proboscis and the flight. And what sets this animal apart from kind of existing studies in insect lateralization is this central proboscis, because most existing studies focus on the use of a left or a right limb, but this is a singular limb or appendage in the center of the body. So it's not quite clear if it's using, oh, the left side or the right side, but rather it's placing it to the left or to the right. So it's kind of a different realm of lateralization. So when this moth is kind of, and here you can see it's inspecting or probing a flat 2D pattern, as it's doing this, you might think of it as kind of making micro decisions almost on where to place the proboscis, to the left, to the right, in front, kind of tucked in. So it's a very complicated and complex mechanism, but we're interested in understanding where lateralization might come into play. And recent work from our group has investigated how visual information is actually used when controlling the proboscis. And what they found was that by painting one eye of the moth, the proboscis actually shifts into the visual field of the free eye. So this also shows that they really only need one eye to accurately inspect these patterns. So this could suggest that maybe they only need one eye to do this task, so it might be tied into a preferred eye or a dominant eye. So we're trying to see if maybe sensory bias has something to do with where this proboscis is being placed. So in the future, we're hoping to replicate these eye painting experiments, but for now, I'll just give you a brief overview of what we're going to do first. And with the data from this study, what was found was that these moths actually do tend to put their proboscis towards one side or the other, and there's a huge variation between individuals as well as within individuals. So this kind of prompts us to further understand, what is this about? Where does it come from? What are the quantitative kind of properties that we can extract from this lateralization? So the first thing that we're trying to see is, again, you can't see it, but the temporal stability or consistency. So over time, how does this lateralization arise or change? Is it something that's fixed and like an innate trait, or is it something that you need experience to develop? So this is kind of one question that we're aiming to tackle. Another question is looking at sensory input. And what I mean by sensory input is these pattern features or pattern stimuli. So here we can visualize where on the patterns these moths are actually touching, but we can actually visualize how the proboscis is actually being used. So these plots are showing kind of isolated heat maps of where the proboscis is being used relative to the animal's midline. So if the animal's head is kind of down at the base of the line, how far away, how close, and how far to the right or to the left is it using its proboscis, no matter which orientation it's in. And we're also interested in looking at how this changes with pattern width. So maybe by increasing the width of a stripe, it's essentially choosing which side to follow. So maybe for these super large stripes or super wide stripes, maybe it's too inefficient to keep switching sides back and forth, and maybe it just wants to pick a side and follow that up to the nectary. That's what we're trying to investigate partially with this. And another way to tie in kind of sensory input is by estimating the visual field. So here is just a very rough estimate. They obviously don't see perfectly 360 degrees, but just to kind of estimate where in the visual field this pattern is. So here, the green dot is the proboscis, the red dot is kind of the head, and then the red line is showing kind of the midline and the orientation. So we're trying to calculate how much of the pattern is in each visual field, and as well as in which region of the visual field is the pattern being placed in. So we're trying to see, is there a correlation between where the pattern is being placed in the eye as well as where the proboscis is being placed? So maybe there is kind of some kind of sensory bias mediating this lateralization. And this might look a little jarring, but this is like a real-time real speed video of what this might look like. So we can see kind of where the proboscis is being placed as well as where the pattern is being placed. And another quantitative measure we can extract out of this is the relative proboscis angle. So compared to the midline, how far to the left or to the right is the proboscis being placed? So here's just some sample data of what that might look like. So we can see over maybe 8,000 frames of a video, so thousands of contacts, this moth has a majority of contacts towards the left of its midline. So this is the type of quantitative information that we can extract from these behavioral data. And lastly, and I'll just do this very, very briefly, we're interested in tying this back into biological relevance. So what does lateralization really mean? So previous studies have tried to correlate the strength of lateralization with performance on a motor task, whether that's gap crossing or jumping away from a predator. So the underlying kind of hypothesis is that stronger lateralization should lead to better performance in a motor task. So we're trying to get like an equivalent of this, and this is still a work in progress. This isn't set in stone, but what might be an equivalent of performance is how fast they can get to the nectary. And this is just some very quick sample data from a pilot study just showing that some moths do actually do this. They get there pretty quick, some don't. So maybe this isn't the best measure of performance, but I'm happy to talk after with anyone if you have any ideas for what performance might look like. And with that, thank you to everybody for listening, and I will end it there. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful. We have time for one quick question.
Okay.
Okay, so afterwards. Okay, our next speaker is Anupama.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. You might have seen me from Lachlan's last picture. I am also part of the Stockel group in my first year. And today I will be talking a little bit on this project I've been working on, which is trying to understand how pattern vision happens in insects. But first, let us introduce what pattern vision is. So here in this image, some things just stand out much faster than other things. And that is because some of these things are more significant to you and have more relevance. And the way that your mind processes and compartmentalizes this is by attributing and processing it in a spatial manner. So basically, we understand patterns as visual inputs, but with a spatial dimension to it. So the same thing is also done by insects, which need to find these really small flowers in this chaotic fields outside. And they're using pattern vision to do it in a more efficient way. Earlier studies that have looked at pattern vision in, this is a study from honeybees, saw that naive animals, so animals that have never before seen patterns, have this preference for these flower-like patterns more than these other things. And a lot of other insects also have these naive patterns. And something else that is interesting is that they seem to be doing pattern generalization, which we see in higher animals. So what this is that once they learn a kind of pattern, you can give them a new pattern, so something they haven't seen before, and they can assess similarity, which is something really interesting for an animal with such few neural resources to do. So for this talk, I'll be focusing more on this innate preference part because we're trying to parse out the rules of how this might be happening. But before that, let me reintroduce our model, the hummingbird hawk moth, which Lachlan already talked about. But just to reiterate, these are day-active moths, which means that they use vision primarily to find flowers. And also they don't land on the flowers they're feeding on and they hover around it, much like a hummingbird, meaning that I can follow the movements of the proboscis on the patterns that I give them and see what bits of the pattern they're actually interacting with, which is great for me. And earlier pattern studies with this moth have found that they do seem to have these preference for patterns as well as colors. So they like this blue and yellow colors. And basically, I'm taking this forward, trying to understand why they have these naive preferences. So one of the naive preferences that I am focusing on is this preference for radial patterns, which they share with other insects, such as the honeybee and the bumblebee, also the hoverfly. So many flower foragers have this preference over the preference for bullseye or concentric patterns. And I'm trying to understand why they might have this or how this might be happening. So one idea about how this is taking place is that they have feature detectors which get triggered whenever certain orientation and edge detectors are activated. And why this might be happening is that these, you know, radial sectors might be acting as nectar guides, which are basically patterns on the flower which potentially direct hovering animals to the center, to basically the nectary. So all of this is speculative in that we don't know if that is exactly what is happening, but I think from the observed behavioral data, this is fairly good assumptions to make. But what I started off with is the question about, is radial really all they're looking at? A good way to figure that out was by giving them this three-way assay. So I have one bullseye not great pattern and two radial patterns with slightly different features. So if all they care about is the overall radiality of it, they should go to both of these with about the same frequency. And that's what I wanted to test with naive animals, so animals that just eclosed. And this was my setup where I had a three-way choice and two of each stimulus. And basically, they could fly for 5 minutes and make as many choices as they wanted. This was video annotated, and I also took down each choice as every time the proboscis touched a pattern. So here you have the probability of an individual choosing one over the other pattern. And as expected, they like radial more than concentric, but also you'll see that there is a difference between the radial patterns, meaning that within the radiality, they're also looking at specific local visual elements before making a choice. So where we go from here is to understand what part of the pattern are they focusing on to make this local inspection. And I gave them many more three-way choices to make with different patterns, for example, to understand, do they want something on the outside? Do they want something inside? Something specific about the radiality? And these are some interesting things I found. So when I gave them this three-way choice and they preferred this, I thought, yes, looks like they really want a radial pattern in the center. But then I switched the contrast and this completely shifted to this one. So it seems like what they care about is having a lighter contrast element in the center. And another set of patterns I gave them, this set, looks like no matter what the contrast type is, they really want a disruption along the radial arm, whatever that means. So basically, I'm going on with more patterns to sort of back up these general ideas I have. And what I think would be really cool to objectively verify this data is to sort of extract the features using computer vision from what we have. So give each of them a bias or some sort of hierarchy to these rules and extract relevant features. And then perhaps put them into a neural network and have it recreate the patterns and see how they match up to the initial patterns and see if what we're thinking about is actually the way it's working. And basically then tie this down to how exactly, the moth is viewing the plant or what features it's giving priority to when it's actually foraging. Basically bringing it back to the biological question of how plant-pollinator interactions have evolved to create patterns that are useful for the plant, but also useful for the moth to efficiently be attracted and then forage and find the nectar. But that's it for this talk, and thank you to everyone who helped design and process the experiment, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Thanks so much, Anupama. Are there any questions?
Is there any parallel in real flowers for the break in the cross that seems to be preferred by the moths?
I can't say for sure. I really hope so, because that would really hold up with what I'm showing. But I mean, flowers do have the radial part, I mean, the central part, where, which is where the nectary is, and then the radial bits I think of as something separate from them. And maybe they're assessing these two separately for different purposes, and that's why the break somehow has like a relevancy and a contrast on-off situation. But again, the way we'd have to connect this to actual flowers is by photographing flowers in the way insects view them, and then maybe trying to find correlates between the patterns we give them and the actual photography, which is not trivial as I've understood it, but that would be really cool to do, I think.
Any other questions? Thank you so much, Anupama. I would like to say thank you to all the PhD students who presented today and presented their amazing work. It's just so great to see what's happening in their PhD theses. Thank you all for coming. It's great to see researchers from all levels here. I see students, I see postdocs, I see PIs. This is wonderful. And yeah, please come again next week and have a good lunch. Thank you.